Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast at the beginning of another broadcast week. We are on every weekday afternoon live with an open phone line for you to call in if you in this coming hour would like to join us asking any questions you have about the Bible or the Christian faith or about Christian doctrine or ethics. And by the way, you don't have to call with the assumption that my answer will be correct. Obviously, some questions are essentially unanswerable because we just don't have enough information to answer them. And some of them may be answerable, but they're also controversial and there are different views on it. So it's not my suggestion that if you ask me a question, that you'll always get the right answer. What my promise is that I'll give you the most biblical answer I know. And if somebody knows a better answer, they can call in and let us know, because that's always a possibility. I don't claim to know everything, but we do our best to answer the questions that are posed if they can be answered without too much difficulty. But that's a, you know, just fair warning. Some questions, the answers to them are a bit controversial. Different Christians see them different ways. And that will be no doubt true of some of the questions that are asked on the program. It often is. In any case, we will discuss them responsibly, hopefully biblically. That will be our intention. And in doing so, we will plan to progress in our understanding of the Word of God. If you see things differently than the host does and you would like to, bring that up, bring up a difference of opinion, feel free to do that as well, because I would be glad to hear what you have to say if it's different than what I think. Because once again, there should be no assumption that this host believes that everything I think has got to be correct. I've changed my mind about things over the years, and I may yet have to do so again someday. And maybe today would be the day if you know something I don't. So that means there's something to be said for calling in and either asking a question or giving us a different viewpoint from what the host has presented here. Now, I have a slight technical problem today, and our studio is working on it. As far as I know, the phones are working. I'm not sure that they are, but my call screening software is not at the moment working, and that means that we're going to have to, if you call in, we're going to have to, well, let me just see. I'm logging back in here. I'll just kind of see if this settles the problem, because if it does, then everything I said about technical problems can just be ignored. So let me see here. Okay. What call? Why don't we go ahead and take it a different way at the moment? Who's the first caller there, Clark? Okay. We're still having a little problem, I guess. We are having some technical difficulties in the studio, it looks like. And so as soon as we can, we will take your call, Cody. I hope you'll hang on there. And that goes for the rest of you. If you want to try to call the program, the number to call is 844-484-5737. And hopefully in a very short time, we'll be able to be processing those calls through our switchboard, which is having a slight problem at the moment. I have a question that was written in by Mark, who asked, and it's a little long, but he said, is sin sin? That's a short question, but he explains what he means by that. Is homosexuality on the same level as maybe gluttony? Is adultery worse than lying? How do we look at tattoos? Old Testament says no, right? Right along with having sex with animals. If tattoos are allowed, is homosexuality allowed as well? Are we soft on some sins and hard on other sins? How can we say sin is wrong when we all, from occasionally to daily, sin? After all, we are all sinners, right? Can sins be classified? Seems homosexuality is carried over into the New Testament, but what about tattoos? How can I make a judgment call on homosexuality when I have sins of my own? Thanks for your help, says Mark. All right, well, obviously there are, he's referring to various laws of the Old Testament, including some that regulate sexual behavior and some that have other things related to them, tattoos and so forth. And he's wondering, you know, how do we know which of these things are really to be retained as guides for our moral behavior? Is it wrong to have tattoos because it was forbidden in Leviticus to have tattoos? And if it's not wrong to have tattoos, is it wrong to engage in homosexual conduct since that too is forbidden in Leviticus? Leviticus forbids both. How do we forbid them both? Do we allow them both? Do we forbid one and not the other? But how do we decide between them? This seems to be the way he's thinking and trying to answer his question. Let me just say that the Bible definitely makes a difference between some sins and others. For example, Paul, when he was writing to the Corinthians in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, was addressing an issue where he had apparently taught the Corinthians when he was present in Corinth. He had taught them that it doesn't really matter what you eat, that unclean foods are not an issue. Even meat sacrificed to idols is not an issue unless it's an issue to your brother, in which case you may be stumbling him and you shouldn't do that. But Paul was saying it really doesn't matter what you eat. And he apparently even said, all things are lawful to me. Now, when Paul said all things are lawful, he meant all foods are lawful. And he explains that in a number of places, including 1 Timothy chapter 4, that all foods are lawful for Christians to eat. And that's because Jesus himself said, it's not what goes into a man's mouth that defiles him, but what comes out of his mouth is what defiles him. Thus, Jesus indicated that all foods are clean. Nothing will defile you to eat it. And so Paul was saying that all foods are clean. There's nothing unlawful to eat. But the Corinthians, who heard Paul say that, were taking his words and extending them far beyond what he intended them to be applied to. Because they were saying, well, it's okay then to commit fornication too, because everything is lawful. Now, Paul had to write to them and correct them about that. In 1 Corinthians 6, he said, well, food is for the belly and the belly is for food, and these things are temporary. They will eventually all be destroyed. But he said, fornication is not what the body is for. The body is not for fornication. Now, fornication is a Greek word that refers to all sexual misconduct. We might think of fornication primarily as premarital sex, but actually fornication in the Greek, porneia, refers to any kind of sex that's not the proper kind or place of sex. So bestiality, incest, adultery, homosexuality, any kind of forbidden sexual behavior would fall under the category of fornication. And Paul said the body is not for fornication. He said other sins are outside the body, but fornication is against your own body, and you defile your body, and your body's the temple of the Holy Spirit, and you don't want to defile the temple of the Holy Spirit. Paul makes that argument in 1 Corinthians 6. So he's making it very clear that although there are laws in the Old Testament about what you can eat and can't eat, he says those things are not really issues in the New Covenant. Those are not real issues to God. But fornication remains an issue. So Paul made it very clear that sexual laws, laws of sexual conduct, are in a different category than laws of what we might call kosher diet, or maybe a more extended category of clean and unclean things. The Old Testament had certain things that were symbolically clean and symbolically unclean. This had much less to do with hygiene than it had to do with symbolism. You could eat certain animals if they had certain characteristics because they symbolized something. And you could not eat other animals that didn't have those characteristics because they symbolized something else. And that being so, these were mainly symbolic rules. Now, symbolic rules had to do with the laws that God gave Israel uniquely, which he did not give to other nations. These were laws that were covenant laws that were kept only because of the covenant that God made with them, Mount Sinai. Now, the Bible indicates that covenant wasn't made with anyone except Israel, and it is no longer a relevant covenant to anybody because there's a new covenant that God has made that has made the old covenant obsolete. So the old covenant indeed was something that Israel was supposed to obey back during the time when it was a relevant covenant. It's not relevant anymore because of the new covenant. Now, under that covenant, God did expect Israel to do things that he didn't expect other nations to do. Now, moral issues like murder and adultery, stealing, dishonoring your parents, and things like that Well, God forbade Israel to do that, but those were things that he forbade everybody to do. Every nation knows you shouldn't murder. Every nation knows that you shouldn't steal. There's laws on the books of every nation against those things. Those are not the special laws he gave to Israel to distinguish the covenant he had with them. Those were simply laws that are universal moral laws, which he happened to repeat with them, but they weren't distinctly the laws that he was making with them. Those laws were the eating laws and other laws that separated them to himself as opposed to other gods' worship. And so circumcision was one of those laws, keeping the Sabbath, keeping festivals, keeping new moons. These were among the ceremonial laws that God gave Israel because they were the distinctive of Israel's behavior in contrast to other nations that didn't follow those things. Tattoos, then, since the question has to do with tattoos, those appear to be of that second category, not the universal moral category, but rather the category of remaining ritually clean, because pagan priests would often tattoo things on them that God didn't want Israel and her priests to put on themselves. Now, the one reason I would suggest that tattoos are not in the same category with, say, the sexual laws that are permanent, the moral laws are permanent, but the tattoos, I think, are probably of the more temporary nature, sort of like festivals and things like that. And my reason for saying that is because tattoos, of course, only affect the outer person. They do not engage a person in immoral conduct. They are only a way in which they mark their bodies or decorate their bodies. In a sense, it's a little bit like the clothes you wear or the hairstyle you wear or something like that, only it's more permanent. You can take your clothes off. You can't take tattoos off easily. But the point here is that whatever is external merely and does not have any impact on the heart can hardly be thought to be a moral issue similar to, say, murder or adultery or stealing. It's rather much closer to issues of style and appearance and things like that. And the Bible makes it very clear that God looks on the heart. Man looks on the outward appearance. So although Israel was, in fact, told not to tattoo themselves, they were also told some other things, too, that we don't follow. I personally believe that tattoos are not forbidden in the New Testament because they are a non-issue. But I wouldn't say that they are a non-issue in terms of common sense. I would say they're a non-issue in terms of morality, depending on their content, of course. I mean, if you're going to tattoo devils and explicit, sexual things on your body, that would have moral impact simply because of the content. The same thing as, putting a bumper sticker on your car advertising some immoral thing. Obviously, Christians would not want to send the wrong message like that. But whether it was moral or immoral to get tattoos, I personally would always advise against getting tattoos, even people who want to get Christian tattoos. And again, I don't judge or condemn people who have such tattoos. But I would just, if somebody asked me, hey, I'm thinking about getting a tattoo, what do you think? I'd say, don't. I'd just say I wouldn't recommend it. And the reason for that is, frankly, I know a lot of people with tattoos. In fact, I have a relative who's a tattoo artist and a very excellent one. He himself is covered with tattoos from head to toe, and he makes his living putting tattoos on people. And I like him. He's a neat guy, and I don't have anything against him or what he does, but he himself wishes he didn't have so many tattoos. He himself has come to tire of it because he feels like people make foolish choices in the tattoos they put on. There are some tattoos people want that he simply won't do it, no matter how much money they offer him. He won't put them on him because, and he's not even a Christian, but he just thinks it's wrong to tattoo certain things on people, and though that's his profession. Now, I'm not a tattoo artist, but just knowing people who have tattoos and knowing how many people wish they didn't have them makes me think, why would I put something on my body that I might, for all I know, wish I didn't have on my body? I mentioned I mentioned bumper stickers. When I was a teenager, I had a VW van, of course, and I just plastered the backside of it with Christian bumper stickers, with Christian slogans and things like that. It was a Christian, a Jesus freak van. And I had all these Christian slogans on bumper stickers. I just thought that was such a great witness, and that was such a cool thing. Of course, I was only 16 years old. And, when I got a little older, I thought, I don't think so. And I could have taken the stickers off if I'd kept the van, but, of course, I don't drive that van anymore. I don't have any bumper stickers on my car today. Why not? Well, I kind of grew up, and I kind of look at bumper stickers a little differently than I did when I was a teenager. But what if instead of bumper stickers, I'd put all those slogans on my arms and my back and my neck? You know, they would still be there today. And I'd be sitting here at age 62 thinking, boy, I forgot not to do that. I wish I had not put those on me. I don't regret that I put bumper stickers on my car when I was 16. But I would certainly regret if those bumper stickers were there forever and if I had to drive a car that was covered with bumper stickers today. All I'm saying is the thing that seems so cool, even that seems like it'd be such a great witness to tattoo on you when you're 16 or even 26 or even 36, because I think 26 is the new 16 and 36 is the new 20. But anyway, the point here is you put a tattoo on, you don't know if 10 years from now you're going to say, you know, I could have used that space a lot wiser, like just by leaving it blank. And yet it's there. It's there. There's one, nothing is sure but this brand new tattoo. And it's sure going to be there in the future unless you pay a lot of money to have it removed. And why? Why bother that? You know, I mean, I realize I'm an old guy from an older generation. And what was cool in my generation wasn't tattoos. It was growing your hair long. Well, I grew my hair long. But if the time came when I didn't like that image, I could cut it off rather easily. Tattoos don't come off so easily. So I just don't think it's wise to permanently do something to yourself that's going to be there when you're 80 years old, but it might not seem as desirable to have it there when you're 80. It's still there. When you make choices in your youth that are going to not change anything for the rest of your life and can't easily change anything for the rest of your life, it's a very serious choice to make. Marriage is a choice like that, and I think people need to be very, very careful about making such choices. Tattoos also, I think, would be a very important one. Not as important as marriage choices, but I do think, I know there are many people covered with tattoos or even have just one tattoo that just kind of wish, I kind of wish I hadn't done that. And it's there it is. And, of course, a lot of people get tattoos before they're Christians, and later they become Christians. Or perhaps they get a tattoo as a Christian, get a Christian tattoo, and then they decide they don't want to be Christians anymore. And now they're a walking advertisement for Jesus, but they don't live for him. And that's a bad thing, too. I just think, why? That's my whole spiel about tattoos. I don't think there's anything about Leviticus's treatment of tattoos that necessarily makes it an immoral thing for Christians to have tattoos. I just think, why? There is such a thing as being wise. And I have never felt that anyone who got a tattoo, even a Christian getting a Christian tattoo, was being particularly wise. But that's my opinion. A lot of people don't care about my opinion. That's okay. They don't have to. But Mark did, and he asked about it. So that's my thoughts about it. Okay. Okay, Clark, who's the next caller?
Line two is Cody from Albany.
Okay, we've been wanting to hear from Cody. Go ahead and put him through. Hello, Cody. Welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you this time. Thank you for persistence.
Oh, yeah, no problem. I will say one thing about tattoos. I agree with that statement. I have tattoos, and I really wish I didn't. But I called for a different reason.
Uh-huh.
And my reason for calling is, I don't know, are you familiar at all with the early Christian view? And when I say early Christian, I mean like from year 100 to 300 to life after death.
Well, I don't know. I can't really say that I do know for sure what the first three centuries of Christians thought about life after death. I'm sure they all believed in the resurrection, as I do. And I do believe that most of them held to the view that the spirit departs from the body. But do you have some other information about that? It sounded like you were maybe wanting to present information about that.
Yeah, well, from what I've read and listened to, the idea presented is more that they believe that you went to, you don't go directly to heaven, you go rather to paradise, and you wait there until the resurrection. And I was thinking for a while, I thought, you know, maybe that, you know, that is maybe the case, you know, because it says, you know, when the dead in Christ shall rise first, we'll be, you know, raised.
Yeah. By the way, Cody, your phone is really, really faint. Are you in a bad spot for your phone, or?
Because
you're fading in and out very, very drastically.
Let me switch to my Bluetooth.
Okay, because I would like to hear you, but it really gets hard when your voice fades way out, and it doesn't work very good for radio. All right. So you're saying that the early Christians from the year 100 to 300, from what you've heard or read, believed that when you die, you go to paradise, but not directly to heaven, and that it's at the resurrection that you leave paradise. Is this what you've read or heard?
Yeah, that's what I've understood from what I've read and what I've heard so far.
And do you know of any of the church fathers? I mean, have you heard the names of any of the church fathers that taught such a thing? Because I've never heard that was the early church view, and I've heard most things about early Christian views, but
I don't know the early church fathers specifically. I mostly heard about it from a CD from David Brousseau. I don't know if you've heard of him.
I know David Brousseau.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's done a lot of extensive work with the early Christians.
Yes, he has.
Writings, and so that's where the thought was originally presented to me.
Well, he could be right. David Brousseau is a fairly expert on the early church fathers. I have heard CDs by him, and I have books by him, but I've never really heard him present that as the view of the early church. But if you heard him say that, he probably has something to base it on from the church fathers. So I wouldn't argue against that. What I would say is that, of course, the church fathers believed a number of things that I don't believe. Because I feel like, just like anybody else, they were capable of having religious traditions and theological traditions that don't necessarily derive from the Bible itself. We do have the Bible, and we can look at what the Bible says. And, of course, the church fathers also were able to look at what the Bible says, and they sometimes reached conclusions that I haven't reached. But then some modern Christians look at the same Bible and reach conclusions that I haven't reached. So there's room for differences of opinion. My own understanding is that paradise, although it can be used as a reference to heaven itself, for example, in 2 Corinthians 12, Paul says he knew a man who's caught up into the third heaven, even into paradise. It would seem, therefore, that the word paradise can be a reference to the third heaven or to heaven. It also is the case that in the Jewish rabbinic teachings, paradise was used as a reference to a compartment in Hades, which was called Abraham's bosom. So the term paradise seems to be used more than one way in Scripture. And it may be, I've always thought it must be a lot like the way we use the word paradise. Think about it. When the word paradise is used, there are some specific places that have that as a proper name, like Paradise, California. But we use the term paradise usually not to refer to a proper name for a certain place, but rather for a certain kind of place. If we say somebody is in paradise, or that we vacationed in paradise, that might be any number of places that are beautiful and pleasant to be in, because the word paradise kind of functions generically that way in our language. And I think it looks like it may, in fact, have functioned that way in biblical usage too, because it seems to be used as a compartment in Hades in Luke chapter 16. It seems to be used to refer to the third heaven where God dwells in 2 Corinthians 12. And it also, in Revelation, refers to the New Jerusalem, paradise, the paradise of God. And I believe that in the Old Testament, I believe in Ezekiel, if I'm not mistaken, paradise is used to refer to the Garden of Eden. In any case, lots of places are referred to as paradise. So it's possible that, you know, the early Christians believed that people went to heaven, but they used the word paradise for heaven, like Paul did in 2 Corinthians 12, or not. I'm not sure, you know, I haven't heard what David Berceau said about it. In my opinion, though, the Bible teaches that when we die, if we're Christians, our soul goes to be with the Lord. And that's what is meant by the expression being absent from the body, but being present with the Lord, that there's part of us that actually does depart from the body and doesn't go to somewhere less than heaven, but goes to the very presence of the Lord, and the Lord is in heaven. Now, some of the church fathers may not have agreed with that, or they might have, and they may have expressed it in different terminology. I don't really know what they believed specifically on that point.
Yeah, because the thing is, the reason why I was wondering about it was because if that's true, because I know that it says, you know, Christ is coming back and we're going to live in the new earth forever.
Yeah, true.
So if it's true that we go to paradise, well, then I guess my question would be, are we ever going to go, you know, to the heaven where Jesus Christ and the Father are now?
Well, so you know, again, that is something that Christians have differed about even today, because there are people like, say, the Seventh-day Adventists and other people who believe in soul sleep. They feel that when you die, you don't go to heaven. You just remain unconscious until the resurrection. And then when you're raised, of course, then's when you go to the eternal state. Whereas most Christians, as I, like myself, believe that when you die, you're not unconscious. You actually go to be in the presence of the Lord, according to the words Paul used. And we remain there until the resurrection. And then, of course, we come back and be part of the new earth and the new Jerusalem with Jesus. So there are different views on that today, regardless of what the church fathers thought. I personally do believe the Bible teaches we will go to heaven. I believe John in Revelation saw the souls of those who were martyrs in heaven, and that's where I expect to go when I die. However, if it turned out that I was mistaken, and instead I was just unconscious until the resurrection, I wouldn't have any complaints about that. And even if I do go to heaven when I die, I don't plan to be there forever. I plan to be there only as long as Jesus is there. But when he comes back here, I plan to come back with him. And that's why it says in 1 Thessalonians 4, I think it's verse 15, if I'm not mistaken, or 14, says that Jesus, when God sends Jesus, he will bring with him those who have died, those who sleep in Jesus. So those who've died are with him. He'll bring them with him. And so I expect to go to be with him, and then I expect him to bring me back here when he comes back here. When he's going to be living here, that's where I plan to be living with him.
Okay, yeah. That makes sense. Yeah, it's just hard, you know, it's hard to, yeah, I mean, I know that if I live for Christ, I'll be when I die, I'll go wherever he is.
Well, sure, yeah, and what does it matter where that place is?
Exactly.
Yeah, I can't even imagine why I would care. I mean, if someone said, well, you're going to spend some time with Jesus in heaven, or you're not going to spend any time with Jesus in heaven, you're going to be spending time with Jesus on the new earth, I think, okay, who cares? Who cares where that is? Spend time with Jesus is, I mean, that's what I'm in this for. The reason I'm a Christian is to be with Jesus. And if he's going to be here, then that's where I want to be. If he's going to be in heaven, I want to be there. The main thing is him. Not only the main thing, the whole thing is him. That's the only consideration I have. Yeah.
That's right. Okay, can I ask you one more question on an unrelated topic?
Yeah, you actually had to wait a long time to get your call through, so I'm going to let you ask another question. Go ahead.
Okay, so I'm, Lord willing, hopefully going to be having a Bible study in my home here in the next couple of weeks, and I was wondering if you had any, basically just some, you know, practical tips in kind of, you know, leading a Bible study.
Have you never led a Bible study before? Is this the
first
time?
I've led discussions, you know, at church and stuff, but I didn't know if there was, you know, anything else that you might be able to give me some wisdom and light on.
Is this a one-time meeting, or are you going to start a weekly thing, or what?
It's going to be every other week.
Okay, and what are you going to study?
Romans.
Romans, okay. Well, my tips would be to teach according to whatever gifting you have. If you don't have any gifting, you probably won't be teaching it for long. If you do have a gifting, then you will have a gifting either that will be more in the area of leading a discussion or lecturing or various things you can do. I would suggest that most teachers ought to, in a home Bible study kind of a thing, in a casual setting, should be ready for, if not encouraging, people to share what their insights are. But also, a teacher should be prepared to distinguish between something being right or wrong that someone shares. A lot of times in Bible studies, it's like nobody acts like they have the right answer, but everybody's answer is equally respected. Well, I respect everybody's right to have an opinion, but I don't respect all answers as equally valid. And so I would suggest that you be quite familiar with the book of Romans. That's the main thing about teaching is you need to know your stuff. You need to know what you're talking about. And so I would suggest just making sure you know the book really well and then conduct the study however the dynamics of the group would make it. Now, if everyone's just quiet and they want you to talk to them about it, then teach it. Just lecture. If they want to have their input, then I'd say, well, that might be a good thing too, as long as you're able to moderate and point out without offending them too much or without embarrassing them when you think they're really off the track. Sometimes it is the case that people will be, they'll be real emphatic, oh, this is what this means, and they really haven't thought it through, and you and maybe others there can see that person doesn't, they're getting it wrong. Now, if everyone can see that they're getting it wrong, it's not even as important that you correct them because they're not going to lead anyone astray. But, how you point out to someone that they're wrong without offending them or insulting them or embarrassing them is maybe the challenge. And that takes a certain grace. That takes a certain relational skill. As a teacher, I don't think you should ever act like you know it all or that the opinion you hold about the passage is necessarily the only one that can be held. I always think it's important for teachers to be quite familiar with the various ways that Christians have understood various things and also to know very well why he or she knows or believes what they do believe. But as far as the logistics of running a meeting, I've never made any suggestions about that for the simple reason that I don't think all meetings should be the same. You know, I tend to be, a lecturer. I mean, if we're going to study a certain thing, I want to have the floor enough to say everything I want to say about it, and that usually takes more time than is available anyway. So, it doesn't end up being like a everybody share their view, please. Some teachers, they'll read a passage and then they'll ask sort of a leading question to the people there. So, what do you think he's talking about here? Why do you suppose he said that? Now, that may be a good thing in some situations, but when I go to a Bible study, I don't want the teacher asking me that. I want him to tell me what he thinks. But there's all kinds of different ways to conduct small group Bible studies, and I wouldn't tell you that one way is the right way. You really have to let it flow from how the Spirit leads you with the particular group and the dynamics of the group that you're with. So I can't be too specific. Unless you have a real specific question about it. I'm not going to lay out a program.
Not really.
I won't lay out a program for Bible studies, yeah.
Yeah, I wasn't necessarily looking for that. Just, I know that, yeah, I mean, I know your style of teaching and lecturing, and, I mean, I've been told I have, the gift of teaching, but at the same time I would like to hear other people's inputs.
Sure.
My biggest concern is, to just kind of not get off task, because I've been in Bible studies where it was just, we would be looking at the passage and then we'd just go off on all these different tangents. And
it ends up being a tangent about Donald Trump or something. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Instead of about the passage, I know, yeah.
Yeah, if you want to have coffee, then come and have coffee. But right now we're going to have a Bible study.
Yeah, that's one thing I would suggest, and that is that you'd be a strong enough guide to the meeting that you don't let it get off on a lot of rabbit trails that are unedifying or that take you totally away from what you're there to study.
Yeah.
Well, okay. I hope it goes well for you.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, Corey, it's good talking to you.
All right.
And God bless you.
is Chris from Canada.
Okay, we're going to talk next to Chris calling from Canada. Chris, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Okay. Thank you, Steve. I'm glad that the technical difficulties are fixed.
Well, they're not entirely fixed, but at least I can talk to the callers. Go ahead.
Well, that's good. My question today is, can you give your input or understanding on the Sigmund Freud's unconscious and the idea that past experiences can at least influence behavior? I mean, we're not saying necessarily cause behavior, but influence behavior. I mean, there are many people. I mean, what about a child that was domestically abused or molested or in some case? I mean, do you think that there is some sort of influence, something that would incline the person as they grow up to maybe sin in a particular way that they wouldn't sin had that not event not happened?
Well, of course. I mean, everybody is shaped by events in their life to some degree. Our attitudes are largely picked up, for example, from the attitudes of our parents about certain things. Our habits are influenced by the way we're trained to develop habits and so forth. Likewise, when we react to childhood traumas, obviously that reaction is, you know, whether a good one or a bad reaction, may set a precedent for reacting similarly to other traumas and so forth. So sometimes by the time people reach their teenage years, they've had so many wrong ways of reacting to trauma or to maybe abuse or other issues that they've got, you know, solid patterns of reacting the wrong way to things. And one could easily say that things that happen in their childhood have therefore influenced their adult behavior. But influenced is one thing. Determining, I think, is an entirely different matter. Now, Sigmund Freud's view of the unconscious was not, he didn't use the word unconscious or subconscious the way that we might think if we're not thinking in Freudian categories. We might just think, you know, I did this unconsciously means I wasn't thinking carefully about what I did. You know, I responded or I acted without giving much thought. And so I would say I was, you know, I did it kind of unconsciously or instinctively. I think we might think unconscious might be sort of like instinctively. We did something without giving it a lot of conscious thought. But the unconscious, in Sigmund Freud's view, and he invented the idea. Freud was the founder of the idea of that we all have an unconscious mind. And that unconscious mind is not simply something that I wasn't thinking about at the time, but it's something that's actually, I'm really not conscious of it. I mean, and I don't have access to it through normal means. I can't just sit and think long enough and remember what's in there. Freud believed that everything that happens to you in, say, the first 7 years of your life especially are marking you in certain ways that will be seen in your behavior afterward, and that these marks are in a realm that you don't know about and you can't know about because it's definitely an unconscious realm. It's a realm that you have no conscious access to. Now, you can get at that information through unusual means, like interpreting your dreams, because he thought your dreams are yielding information from your unconscious, and if someone knows how to interpret them, then you can find out something that's going on in your unconscious mind. But dreams are a very special kind of revelation rather than just rational thought. Likewise, hypnosis and some other things, even the use of cocaine, I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think Freud used cocaine sometimes with some of his patients, you know, getting people to, you know, get into an altered state of consciousness in a way, to get at that hidden realm of the personality that's unconscious to a person when they're in their normal state of mind, is he believed that we have this unconscious realm and that it dictates who we are and what we do to a very large extent. Now, I'm not an expert about Freud, but I've certainly read what many people can read about him, about these matters. And I would have to say I don't know if there is such an unconscious mind, but if there is, it must not be as important in dictating behavior as Freud thought it was, for the simple reason that God never mentions whether such a thing exists. And since God is very concerned throughout Scripture about our behavior, especially about our sanctification, about our being transformed into the image of Christ, in our changing our patterns of sinful behavior and exchanging them for patterns of holy conduct. If the unconscious mind played some kind of a significant role in this behavior, then I'm sure God would mention it. And if he didn't, he was very negligent. If we needed to be hypnotized or have our dreams analyzed in order to get our lives right, well, that'd be a very good thing for God to mention, especially in a book or 66 books where he's really dealing primarily with those issues of, you know, how we live a holy life. So I think that since God doesn't mention it, and it would be a very significant factor to include in the kinds of concerns that the Bible deals with, that it probably isn't true. It's probably a theory that is not the case. Now, Freud believed that there's a lot of repressed memories. They're not real memories because we can't remember them, but they are in there, sort of in the unconscious memory realm, and they've been repressed because they're too painful. And we have also a lot of repressed sexual aggression and things like that, and a lot of motivations in our unconscious mind that we don't even know are there. Frankly, you know, some of the things that Freud said are there, I'm quite sure are not there. I mean, the Oedipus complex, for example, just doesn't. You know, I don't think I've ever met a person of whom the Oedipus complex could be said to be true, except maybe Freud himself. I haven't met him, but it, you know, Freud believed that every boy wants to kill his dad and sleep with his mom. Well, I never wanted to kill my dad or sleep with my mom, and I don't think I've talked to any. I don't think I've ever talked to any sane person who really did want to. But since Freud thought every boy wanted to, he certainly must have wanted to. Obviously, if he didn't, he wouldn't think it was true of all people. So I think in many cases, Freud's theories tell us more about him than about anyone else. And he was kind of a messed up guy. I mean, this has little to do with the validity of his beliefs about the unconscious or the subconscious mind. But, I mean, he was not really the kind of guy that we should be looking to for help in being balanced, well-adjusted, or certainly holy people. Freud was an atheist himself. He was terrified of death. He could not attend a funeral. He was too paranoid of death. When his colleague, his young colleague, Carl Jung, did displays of supernatural things like causing a big bang to come out of a bookshelf near Freud, Freud fainted. He was a very fearful man. He was not a balanced man. Like I said, he must have wanted to kill his dad and sleep with his mom because he thought everyone wanted to do that. It's really hard to know exactly why people have looked to a man like this to guide them into realms of understanding normal behavior. I don't think this man was necessarily characterized by normal behavior. But then that's interesting because an awful lot of people who go see therapists, and I'm not trying to put down therapists particularly, but and many therapists, they don't follow Freud. There's different forces of psychology, and Freud was the first force. Jung had another revolution in psychology, and then there's, of course, the humanist psychologists like Maslow and Carl Rogers and people like that. And there's a lot of different therapists who don't follow Freud particularly, but in the realm of secular psychology, it's a very commonplace thing that the therapist that you go to see is himself or herself seeing a therapist for his own or her own issues. I mean, it's like they consider this is just normal. You can't deal with life without a therapist. And I think an awful lot of people go into therapy as a profession. Not all of them, certainly not all of them. But many of them do because when they were choosing a profession, they themselves felt helped or encouraged or whatever by being in therapy, and they continue in therapy. A great number, Carl Rogers and other major leaders in psychological thinking themselves were seeing therapists in their professional life. So it's clear that they themselves could not have thought that they are dealing with the world in a completely independent way without relying on a therapist. And, of course, they no doubt figured that nobody could deal with the world without a therapist. Again, people tend to think everyone is like themselves. Freud apparently thought everyone was like himself. And when people are themselves very, very much dependent on therapists to help them cope in life, they assume that everyone should be seeing a therapist to cope in life. And, you know, the unconscious mind, that was Freud's darling. That was his invention. And his protege, Carl Jung, expanded that to the collective unconsciousness, which he thought the whole human race shares an unconscious mind. And that was another interesting thing. But all these guys, they were just theorists. They don't know. You know, the Bible says, blessed is he who does not walk in the counsel of the ungodly. And if we go to counselors or therapists, and they're giving us counsel, but they're ungodly, or the people they studied under, the people they formed their views under, the people who shaped the kind of counsel they give are ungodly, I think we're looking the wrong place. I think we're looking the wrong place for help.
Yeah, I agree. And I, you know, I've actually through some of my research, I've noted that actually not every psychologist even believes in the unconscious. There are some that believe.
Right.
There are some that believe that past experiences like trauma and such only affect behavior long term if it's something that the person could recall if they sat down on a couch and thought about it. But they would
right.
say that any sort of trauma that's happened, maybe when you're 2 or 3 years old, yes, that's horrible and awful, and obviously it is, and it certainly did affect the person in the moment and during that time. But if they can't remember it now, and it's something that's not remembered, that's completely out of their conscience, they say that, well, how could that be dictating behavior? Now, obviously, there's Freud would say, and the people that follow Freud, they would say that, no, your body remembers it, so it does affect your behavior no matter what.
Well, Freud launched the psychotherapeutic revolution, but not all therapists are Freudian now. Like I said, there's behaviorists, you know, and there's humanists, and there's psychoanalysis followers, and there's a lot of different schools of psychology, and certainly not all of them buy into Freud's unconscious mind.
One concern I actually have, and it's actually a concern that a lot of people have had, is what I think they call it false memory syndrome, where
yep.
like parents and such have been, and adults have been accused of molesting their daughter or something, and then it's been later on found out that that wasn't even true, and the accusations were being made simply from something, because the psychologist has convinced the person this must have happened to you, when there wasn't 2 or 3 witnesses like the Bible said there needs to be. There wasn't mm-hmm. any sort of evidence that this had actually happened. So yet they're being charged for doing something that there's no real proof that they did.
That's a very important observation. That's where Freudism can become really evil, is where an innocent person, usually a father or an uncle or somebody, is accused of having molested a young girl, but the young girl didn't know it in her youth. It's when she's in her 20s or 30s or 40s that a psychotherapist is drawing it out of her and very likely creating memories de novo in her mind by suggestion. And now she says, oh, suddenly I remember my father molested me. But she didn't know it for the first 30 years of her life. And probably he never did any such thing. But anyone who goes to a therapist is already admitting they're having a hard time kind of coping with reality without the help of a therapist. And the trust that they put in their therapist is often so great. They think that their therapy is scientific, you know, and who would dare to disagree with science? That's what Freud did for psychology. Psychology, the idea of counseling people with their traumas and things like that existed before Freud. But before Freud's time, that was in the realm of philosophy. It wasn't considered to be science. But
right.
because he was a medical doctor, so he gave a scientific ranking to his views, although they weren't scientific at all.
Yeah, and the thing that the reality is, and I mean, obviously, I would agree and believe that there are truths to the fact that children are molested, obviously, and it's perhaps possible that they were at the age where you don't remember. I mean, I don't remember a lot of my childhood. So it's certainly mm-hmm. possible, but the point is that Jesus takes care of your past. That this whole idea that you can't change your behavior until you find proof that this happened and psychoanalyzed it is not really there. Jesus took care of your past.
Yeah.
I mean, if you think that you remember that maybe so-and-so did something, don't go and lay charges on the person. Ask God to help you forgive the person, move forward, and walk in the spirit, because the reality is that there's no proof that someone did it. You should not be seeking to punish someone if there's no proof that they did it. And you certainly should not just be living in bondage to sin simply because of a memory that you can't get access to. And I don't think that there's any biblical evidence that we should be practicing things like hypnosis and all this. These theories that aren't scientifical. I mean, I'm reading a book by the Bob Martin Deidre Bomgan, and he's talking about how unscientifical these ideas are that we're told are scientifical, and there's no proof of them. They're just theories like another religion. So we might as well follow Mormonism or Buddha if we're going to follow all these psychological ideas.
That's right. Hey, I'm running out of time, but I appreciate your call, Chris.
No worries. I like talking to you. So we'll talk next time.
All right. Well, thanks for calling. We're going to try to get another call in from David from Portland next. David, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
You're welcome. I was talking to a rabbi about Isaiah 9:6, and it says, unto us a son is given, unto us a child is born, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father. And because he didn't believe that the Messiah was going to be God, and I was using that as a proof that that the Messiah would be God. But then he says that his version doesn't read that way, and I just had a question. How good is the... It seems like every version that I've ever read, it's like that, you know, but then I've read that there are different ways it can be translated. And anyway,
I don't know of very many significantly different ways that can be translated, and I don't know what the Hebrew Bible now would say, because I mean, obviously the Jewish people have been dealing with the claims of Christianity for 2,000 years now, and the rabbis have come up with their alternative explanations of many passages which they would not have been even thinking about or defensive about previously. But, you know, the New Testament, to a very large extent, follows the Septuagint version, not the Hebrew Bible anyway. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking at the Septuagint right now, which would be the form of Isaiah that the New Testament writers and all the Jews of their time pretty much used. I mean, it wasn't just Christians. The Septuagint was the Bible in Greek that the Greek-speaking people of the first century, which is just about everybody, used. And it says here in the Septuagint, "For a child was born to us, a son was given to us, of whom the sovereignty became upon his shoulder, and his name is called of Great Counsel, Messenger, Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Potentate, Ruler of Peace, Father of Eternity." And so he is called the Mighty God in the passage. And so I personally think that your rabbi, I don't know what his said. If you told me what his version said, I could tell you, you know, what I think about that. But, you know, rabbis are going to do an awful lot to try to debunk most of the Christian claims about the Old Testament. Anyway, I appreciate your call, though I'm out of time. Let's talk about this again sometime if you want to call up. The Narrow Path. Yes, thank you. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. We are a listener-supported ministry. If you'd like to help us out, you can go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. That's thenarrowpath.com, and there's a donation link there. There's also many resources there, all of them free, at thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Let's talk again tomorrow.